This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd. President Joe Biden is hailing House passage of his $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill. We get more from AP's Sagar Meghani.
From President Biden,
this bill represents a historic victory for the American people.
To House Speaker Nancy Pelosi,
this is a momentous day in the history of our country.
To number two Senate Democrat Dick Durbin,
the most dramatic change in America in modern times with this legislation. This is historic.
House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy agrees.
The most expensive single bill in American history.
But says that's not a good thing. Democrats spent way too much to do far too little, focusing on their own wish list instead of what Americans actually need. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
California Governor Gavin Newsom says his state is on track to further ease coronavirus restrictions. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The governor says the number of coronavirus cases is dropping. Good news for areas in the purple tier, which have the highest restrictions.
Southern California, you will be a beneficiary of this. Specifically, LA will be a big beneficiary of this new metric that likely will be met.
California has a retooled equity strategy for getting more vaccine to communities hard hit by the pandemic.
The 2 million goal, which is our short-term goal to address the issue of equity, and to make sure that we're administering in a targeted manner these vaccines. We're at 1.9 million.
California began vaccinating people in December, but didn't commit 40% of its doses to the most vulnerable people until last week. I'm Ed Donahue.
A mixed day on Wall Street, with the Dow Jones Industrials and the S&P closing higher, but the Nasdaq off slightly. The Dow rose 1.46%. The S&P added 0.6%. The Nasdaq dropped by 0.04%. This is VOA News. The UN Security Council agreed on a statement Wednesday to condemn the military government's use of violence against peaceful protesters in Myanmar. Diplomats said the agreement was the result of a rare show of unity over Myanmar among the council's 15 members that includes China. Meanwhile, in Myanmar, security forces continued their crackdown on opposition to the February 1st military coup. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
Video shows tear gas rising and billowing as protesters disperse. There were also reports of the use of rubber bullets, although no injuries have been confirmed. Earlier, a march got underway with protesters chanting for the end of military rule. Also, Myanmar security forces raided a neighbourhood in the country's largest city, that's home to state railway workers who've gone on strike alongside other worker groups. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan will meet with their Chinese counterparts in Alaska next week, the first meeting of senior American and Chinese officials since President Joe Biden took office. Blinken and Sullivan will meet with the People's Republic of China's Director of the Office of the Central Commission for Foreign Affairs, Yang Jiechi, and State Councilor Wang Yi on March 18th in Anchorage. Blinken will be making his first overseas trip next week with visits to Japan and South Korea alongside Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. The Alaska meeting will take place following Secretary Blinken's meetings in Seoul and Tokyo. A week ago, the Secretary of State declared the relationship between Washington and Beijing is the world's biggest geopolitical test of the century. The head of the UN Food Agency warned after a visit to Yemen that his underfunded organization might be forced to seek hundreds of millions of dollars in private donations in a desperate bid to stave off widespread famine in the coming months. David Beasley told the Associated Press the world needs to wake up to how bad things have gotten in Yemen, particularly for the country's youngest, some of whom he had seen in hospital beds in a Sana'a hospital.
It's a horrific situation. It really is. I went to the best hospital in Sana'a, room to room, and I saw children literally dying.
The UN has warned that 16 million people in Yemen, or about one half the country's population, could face serious food insecurity. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Another Ivory Coast prime minister has died.
Mr. Bakayoko was sick. He became prime minister, I believe, in the first week of July 2020, and he replaced the late and former prime minister, Amadou Gon Coulibaly, who was the choice of Mr. Ouattara, you know, to succeed him when he retired.
Senegal's pro-democracy groups call for a Wear White protest tomorrow, Friday. The COVID-19 pandemic takes a unique toll on South Africa's disabled. Kenya's ambassador to South Korea faces threats of recall for her dual citizenship. And where is Tanzanian President John Magufuli?
Magufuli is in Nairobi. He's in hospital. And he's been in Nairobi, from my information, since Monday evening.
And Malawi is set to debate liberalizing abortion in the face of conservative opposition. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Another Ivory Coast prime minister has died in less than a year. Hamed Bakayoko, who was seen as a possible successor to President Alassane Ouattara, died Wednesday in Germany. President Ouattara described the late prime minister as a great statesman, a model for the youth, a personality of great generosity and exemplary loyalty. Bakayoko was appointed by President Ouattara last July following the death of Prime Minister Gon Coulibaly. Nyaka Lagoke is assistant professor of history and Pan-Africana studies at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, and also an Ivorian.
Mr. Bakayoko was sick. He became prime minister, I believe, in the first week of July 2020, and he replaced the late and former prime minister, Amadou Gon Coulibaly, who was the choice of Mr. Ouattara, you know, to succeed him when he retires. And then there was a power struggle around Mr. Ouattara between Amadou Gon Coulibaly, who died last year, and Ahmed Bakayoko, who died today, and then Mr. Ouattara's brother, who is the Minister of Presidential Affairs, and so on, and some other ones. So it is a shocking news for the country. We have lost two prime ministers in less than 1 year. So it is scary, and many people are thinking about the worst. And then also, the one who replaced Ahmed Bakayoko, Patrick Achi, we heard that he is sick also, that he's been transferred to Paris today.
Are you saying Patrick Achi?
Yes, Patrick Achi is also believed to be sick too, and he was taken to Europe.
President Alassane Ouattara described the late Bakayoko as my son and close collaborator. Some people say that President Ouattara was trying to groom the late Bakayoko and even the previous prime minister.
No, it is not true. He might have groomed Amadou Gon Coulibaly, who died last year, to become president after him, but not Ahmed Bakayoko. Because of Mr. Ouattara, he made a statement last year when he was convincing people that he needed to be there for the third term. And he said that it took him 3 decades, you know, for him to groom Amadou Gon Coulibaly. That's why, you know, if Gon is gone, he don't see any other person that can be there. He said that himself publicly. But Ahmed Bakayoko, of course, was very close to Mr. Ouattara. You know, we belong to the same generation. When I was fighting for freedom under the wings of Gbagbo, Ahmed Bakayoko was close to Mr. Ouattara. He created a newspaper called Le Patriot. Later on, he became the managing director of a private radio founded by Ouattara and his wife, Radio Nostalgie. And then after that, I was seen as the golden boy of the press in Ivory Coast. And when there was a rebellion, as it was, Mr. Ouattara, who is the godfather of the rebellion, he became a very prominent political figure, and he became a minister under Gbagbo, but on behalf of Mr. Ouattara's party. And when Ouattara became the president, in 2011, then he became the Minister of Interior and Security, a little Minister of Defense. And then when Amadou Gon died, and then it's like he forced Mr. Ouattara's hand to appoint him as the Prime Minister. But Ouattara did not want him because they said that he has some limited intellectual capabilities, but they put him there. And now we heard the news that he was poisoned. And then like many other people were poisoned in the country, And then all the fingers are pointing at people close to Mr. Ouattara, including his brother.
Did you say that Bakayoko, there's news that he was poisoned?
The credible sources say that Mr. Bakayoko was poisoned. This is what many people in Ivory Coast think, and this is what I'm sharing with you.
Nyaka, thank you very much again. We're always very happy to have you.
Thank you, Roland.
Nyaka Lagoke is Assistant Professor of History and Pan-Africana Studies at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Senegal's Movement for the Defense of Democracy has called for a white symbolism tomorrow, Friday, calling on Senegalese to wear or decorate their homes and cars with white to mourn all those killed during a week of protest. The group has also called on Senegalese to turn out this Saturday with their national flag for a peaceful demonstration. This comes after the group suspended protest on Tuesday and yesterday, Wednesday, because it said it took into consideration recent developments, including the release from prison of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko. However, Yassine Fall, an ally of Sonko, says the purpose of Saturday's protest will be to demand the immediate and unconditional release of all political prisoners.
We're planning a demonstration this coming Saturday because many people have been incarcerated. We have a large number of political prisoners. Several people have lost their lives because the government have decided to fire demonstrators with real bullets, and several people were killed, about 11, many of them minors who are not even 18. The second reason why we are going to demonstrate is that over 500 people have been injured. Some of them lost a limb. So this is a very serious issue. We cannot just settle down because Ousmane Sonko has been let to go home, but there are still charges on him. He is not allowed to travel. He is not allowed to talk about the case. He doesn't have his total freedom. And he has not also been completely cleared. And we want a free and fair trial so that he can clear his name and he can really, you know, go about his political activities.
You are calling for the unconditional release of political prisoners. Who are those political prisoners?
Our demands for this coming Saturday are really for freeing all political prisoners and for the government to provide assistance to the families of those who have lost their lives.
Your leader, Ousmane Sonko, was quoted as saying that the revolution has already started and nobody can stop it. What revolution is he talking about?
Sonko is saying that this is the beginning of a revolution because for the first time in Senegalese history, we have never seen so many young people standing up and saying no to injustice, saying no to the taking away of our democracy, and standing up to say that they want justice. We are saying that we are no longer going to accept a government that is almost now getting dictatorial.
You are calling for the unconditional release of political prisoners. Who are those political prisoners?
Political prisoners are whistleblowers who have really been, showing evidence of corruption at the highest level in the state.
You mentioned in your press release that you were to announce a new slogan for the movement. Is that correct? If so, what is the new slogan?
We call upon people on Friday to wear white, to put white in front of their houses, a white piece of cloth to put it on their cars, so that it is our way of mourning all of the dead. We also said that on Friday, we all call Senegalese to come out peacefully on Saturday for a demonstration, everyone to bring the Senegalese flag. We also said that we're going to release a memorandum with all of the requests that we are making.
Yassine Fall is a political ally of Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko. She was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. Tanzania's main opposition leader, Tundu Lissu, says he has information from reliable sources that President John Magufuli is in the hospital in Kenya suffering from COVID. All attempts to get Tanzanian government officials to comment on the news were fruitless. Reuters news agency reported that Kenya's foreign ministry and Nairobi hospital both said they had no information to disclose. President Magufuli has been in denial of COVID-19, telling Tanzanians instead to put their trust in prayer and homemade treatment. He was last seen in public on February 27. Lissu said if Tanzanians don't believe what he is saying, then they should reveal President Magufuli's whereabouts. That was Tundu Lissu, Tanzania's main opposition leader. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 11. A pandemic poses an even greater challenge for the estimated 3 million South Africans who classify as disabled. VOA's Anita Powell visits a community of blind burn victims in Johannesburg and brings us this story about the unique toll that the coronavirus pandemic has taken on this community.
Marie-Louise Ganyile was born with albinism, low vision, and poor hearing. She married and bore 11 children. Then, at the age of 29, she realized she was going totally blind. That sense of helplessness drove her to attempt suicide. Now, more than two decades later, stress is again bearing down on her. Like many members of South Africa's 3 million-member disabled community, she says the COVID-19 pandemic has dealt her severe hardship. But this time, she's not defeated. She's angry.
Our government doesn't care about us. That COVID, I did not hear anyone or from the radio or from the TV to say the government, there is a workshop or anything to help the people with living with disability. I didn't hear anything. So to me, our government, they just put us behind.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has addressed his nation numerous times in the years since the pandemic started. In his televised appearances, he's addressed the nation's fears and announced a raft of social and economic interventions. But Ganyile says he hasn't spoken about the unique toll the pandemic has taken on the disabled community. Members of South Africa's blind community say the pandemic restrictions, from lockdowns to social distancing, have dealt a huge blow to their independence. The gloves and masks used to protect against COVID-19 blunt their senses of smell and touch, and social distancing limits how other people can physically guide them. Bronwyn Jones started a home and school in 2003 for young burn victims, many of whom are blind. It started with Dora, her now 26-year-old daughter, who she adopted as a young child. Dora was badly burned as an infant and lost her eyes, nose, and hands. Dora is a fixture in her Johannesburg neighborhood and, before the pandemic, was often seen walking the streets or browsing local shops with friends. Her mother lives in fear of what will happen if she gets the coronavirus.
The powers that be would probably say she could die because they don't care about very disabled people and they don't want to spend money on them. And they make a judgment about highly disabled people and they think their lives aren't worth living. So that is brutally scary, that they think people's lives are worth nothing.
Running an institution for disabled children has been especially rough during this pandemic, Jones said. Donations have dried up, and keeping the children safe from viral exposure is a constant challenge. But Jones says when she's down, she looks to her daughter and the other kids in her home. She says these children have already mastered something their abled counterparts are only now learning how to do, survive. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Kenya's ambassador to South Korea, Mwende Mwinzi, is facing threats of recall from her post by parliament over questions about her dual citizenship. Parliament demanded that she renounce her American citizenship, but her lawyers said she became an American by birth and not naturalization, which qualifies her under the Constitution. Analysts say the outcome may determine if dual citizens can hold public office in the country. For more on the controversy, VOA's International Edition's Chinedu Ofor reached Tom Ojienda, attorney for Mwizi.
The concern during appointment was the fact that she holds a dual citizenship of the United States of America and of Kenya. Parliament then had a concern about her allegiance to Kenya and therefore was questioning whether the event of conflict between her interests in the U.S. and other interests of where she serves in Korea, whether she would do allegiance. And these are questions she responded to in Parliament. And she did confirm that she owes allegiance to Kenya and that those particular questions of conflict do not arise or have not arisen at all. We had a court intervention. We went to court. And the High Court, Justice Makau, did point to the fact that a dual citizen by birth and not by choice cannot be compelled to renounce a citizenship.
Local media is reporting that several members of parliament also have dual citizenship. Why do you think the ambassador is being singled out?
This is political. It's beyond my understanding. I do not know why they would single out Mwende Mwinzi for this discrimination. But also, we know that there are even Kenyans who serve as consulars for other states. They are Kenyans, but they are serving interests of other nations. And while they sit in Kenya, I know a number of Kenyan citizens who are heading foreign missions in Kenya for other countries. I do not understand what the concern is and why Mwende Mwinzi is singled out. There are many dual citizens who hold public office, and I don't understand why her case seems to take a different turn. I think we'll be asking the court to put a final mark on this question so that she does not go through the tragedy that she's going through.
She is a sitting ambassador of Kenya to South Korea. Do you think Parliament has the powers to recall her?
The question of an individual who is already serving and appointed is no longer a question for the institutions of the country. It is His Excellency the President that has made the final appointment and posting, and that is for us an act of finality. And that is what the individuals who have come to us to go to court are saying, that this is no longer a Mwende Mwinzi question. This is a question for Kenya as a country, because she's already appointed and serving, and not for institutions in the country to come questioning processes that are already done, because it's completely unfair. I'll tell you this. This is an affront and looks a bit personal to Mwende Mwinzi. And let me say that exactly the president has done the correct thing.
Your legal options. Where are you at the moment, and what do you intend to do?
What I intend to do is very simple. I have dual citizens and other actors from the civil society, the organizations who have instructed me, to put in a further case in court, which I shall be doing tomorrow morning. So we are on course on all this. We shall protect and ensure that we exhaust this process up to the Supreme Court.
That was Tom Ojienda, attorney for Kenya's ambassador to South Korea, Mwende Mwinzi, speaking from Nairobi with viewers Chinedu Ofor. Abortion is illegal in Malawi unless the mother's life is at risk. But that doesn't stop an estimated 140,000 women per year having unsafe terminations that leave 12,000 women dead and countless others permanently scarred. Despite these numbers, efforts to liberalize current abortion laws are facing resistance from conservative groups. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
After getting pregnant at age 17, Melita, not her real name, saw abortion as her only option to stay in school. But Malawi's 160-year-old abortion law only allows termination to save the life of a mother. So Melita went to a witch doctor. She says a few hours after taking a concoction of herbs, she started bleeding heavily. The pain felt around my cervix was unbearable, and I started crying while rolling on the floor. Melita's uterus had ruptured and had to be removed. Though she can no longer have children, Melita knows she was lucky. I have heard stories of women dying from backstreet abortions, she says. So after experiencing persistent abnormal pain and bleeding, says Melita, I was very scared that I would also die. Research by the U.S.-based Gutmacher Institute and the Malawi College of Medicine shows 140,000 Malawian women have unsafe abortions each year. The dangerous procedures leave about 12,000 of them dead, and countless survivors like Melita permanently scarred. Campaigners have since 2015 been pushing a bill on expanding legal abortions to cases of rape, incest, fetal deformity, and threats to health. Brian Ligomeka is with the Safe Abortion Campaign Group.
There are additional three grounds that are there. When enacted, the new law will allow women who face physical and mental dangers to their lives to access abortion.
But protests in 2016 from conservative and religious groups who call an abortion murder delayed debate on the bill. Pastor Zaki Kawalala is a church leader in Blantyre.
God considers life from conception. God knows you while you are in your mother's womb. God blesses you in your womb. And the Bible also tells us in Jeremiah chapter 20 that thank God that the womb of my mother was not my grave. If somebody dies before they are born, it is like the womb was their grave.
Malawi's lawmakers are expected to finally debate the bill before the current parliamentary session ends on March 26. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that's it for this Thursday, March 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.